Good afternoon, this is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. Well, I've been at it again. I've been watching the TV astronomy shows. And again, very interesting stuff about the origins of life on Earth. And all Earth has had to go through in order to get where we are today. A lot of extinctions, mass extinctions, a lot of traumatic things happening, meteor strikes, a planet hit us, which led to the creation of the moon. And we're here still after all that. So let's talk about a bit about how we got to where we are today, where we started and where we got today. So we all know the solar system took form about 4.5 billion years ago. And I don't know how much longer we have here on Earth. The last thing I heard was that in 500 million years, the sun will become so hot, it's expanding, it's getting hotter, its outer shell will expand out, and the age of the animals will be over. So that's the prediction right now. It was longer than that before, but then that projection was revised. So it's possible the age of the animals on Earth, if we don't populate any other planet or any other moon in the solar system, it will be extinguished. So that's what scientists are saying. So let's go back to the beginning where they're saying life on Earth started, the origins of life on Earth. So we have single cell bacteria taking form about 3.5 billion years ago or so, they say, in Western Australia. And at that time, the Earth didn't have an oxygen atmosphere. I believe the color of the sky was orange, and it was a different place. The moon was closer to us. There was thousands or kilometers, thousands of feet, or a kilometer, two, three. The waves would be very high. The moon was closer, so it existed a greater tug on us. And life started 3.5 billion years ago. So they said, it started with a cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae, started out on Earth about 3.5 billion years ago. So apparently what it started out was in underwater vents, if there was water in the Earth at that time, but volcanic vents, that's where life started. So it was hot by the vents, and there was no oxygen, but somehow life got started then. And the bacteria was very important because it created oxygen when it breathed in and took in the carbon dioxide, and then the Earth slowly got an oxygen atmosphere. So this was all the bacteria is doing. So that the cells didn't have any organelles, they were just simple bacteria. I guess they call it prokaryotic, single cell. The structures inside, the tiny structures inside the cell carried out specific functions, but there was no distinct nuclei, and the genetic material was mixed in with all the rest of the cell. So this is not astronomy, but it mixes in with astronomy, doesn't it? All forms of life on Earth, including real algae, consist of eukaryotic cells with organelles and with genetic material contained in one place, which is the nucleus. So before it was different. And bacteria are hardy creatures. Apparently they've been found on meteorites that have landed on Earth. They survive all this thing, and there was even speculation. It's hard to know because we can't go back 3.5 billion years ago. Some people even said that we're Martians because the bacteria could have come from Mars, from a meteor or something, and hit the Earth. But anyway, we have a prokaryotes were the simplest life forms, simple creatures that fed on carbon compounds that were accumulating in Earth's early years. And slowly other organisms evolved that use the sun's energy along with compounds such as sulfide to generate their own energy. So cyanobacteria then went a step further. They started to utilize water during photosynthesis, releasing oxygen as a byproduct. Over time, enough oxygen accumulated in Earth's atmosphere to allow for evolution of oxygen metabolizing organisms. So when we go out into the universe searching for life beyond our own planet, we're thinking we're most likely to find it lurking somewhere where there's water. And there was, of course, harsh conditions. The early Earth was basically, I think it was a lava ball. And then, of course, we know that a planetoid hit our Earth and giant impact, and that debris went up in the atmosphere and outside of the atmosphere, and it coalesced to form the moon. So here we have it. We have the beginnings of life. And in harsh conditions, there was the, I guess it's called early to late heavy bombardment, which was a bunch of meteor strikes that hit our moon, and it's called the late heavy bombardment. So what the late heavy bombardment was, our lunar cataclysm, is a hypothesized event thought to have occurred approximately 4.1 to 3.8 billion years ago. So that's before life formed on Earth, at a time corresponding to the Neo-Hadean and Eoarchean eras on Earth. During this interval, a disproportionately large number of asteroids are theorized to have collided with the earlier terrestrial planets in the inner solar system, including Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. Since 2018, the existence of the late heavy bombardment has been questioned. So evidence for the late heavy bombardment derives from lunar samples brought back by the Apollo astronauts. So that was before life, but it just, life took hold on Earth. But as we can see, there was a cataclysmic event there. So I'm going to go on now and bypass some of the years of that evolution. I'm going to go to something, an article I have here. It said, How Earth Became a Giant Snowball 700 years ago. So around 717 million years ago, the Earth froze over. The Sturtian glaciation, as this event is known, was no ordinary ice age, but one so extreme that it caused the Earth to become a giant snowball for at least 5 million years. How it happened has been a mystery for the ages until now. In a new study, Harvard scientists suggest that the answer might lie in the way volcanoes' eruptions caused the Earth's temperatures to plummet. So what I saw in the show last night on BBC Earth was that about 717 million years ago, I guess in the northern territories of Canada, series of eruptions of volcanic eruptions, they could have lasted years, they could have lasted decades, they clouded the skies and froze out the sun. So that it's called, at the heart of this mystery is the Franklin Large Igneous Province, LIP, which extends across modern-day Alaska, Greenland, and northern Canada. An LIP is a vast swath of igneous magmatic rock that is associated with a hotspot, regions within the mantle where rocks melt to form magma. The birth of these formations are cataclysmic events, resulting in various kinds of mayhem, including mass extinctions and devastating climate change, as enormous clouds of volcanic matter are released into the atmosphere for geological short periods, about a few million years. So as we can see, life had its challenges because of these cataclysmic events. So that was one of them, called the Sturtian glaciation, and apparently lasting for about 5 million years, but then life came back. Life somehow survived. The Franklin LIP formation coincides with the onset of the Sturgeon glaciation. But exactly what made these volcanic eruptions different from others? Robin Woodworth, an assistant professor at, doesn't say where, but professor of environmental science and engineering, points out, such events are by no means unique, and if the planet froze over every time there was a volcanic eruption of this nature, we'd all be in trouble. So apparently, when this event was over, then everything was nice again on Earth, life started to thrive. So as we can see, there was challenges from the beginning and challenges through Earth's history. Now, next one I'm going to call or look at is, there is one called, what's it called? Wikipedia is jumping around to me. I just donated some money, so they think they can play around with me. So what's it called? Hang on, I'm going to go back. It didn't go back to my original page. So there was apparently lots of eruptions in volcanoes in Russia. And I could be wrong, but this could be called the Great Dying, which is the Permian Triassic Extinction Event, also known as P-TR Extinction. And colloquially as the Great Dying, formed the boundary between the Permian and Triassic geological periods, as well as between the Paleozoic and Mesozoic areas, approximately 251.9 million years ago. It is the Earth's most severe known extinction event, with up to 96% of all marine species and 70% of terrestrial vertebrate species becoming extinct. It was the largest known mass extinction of insects. So 50% of biological families and 83% of all genera became extinct. There's evidence for 1 to 3 distinct pulses or phase of extinction. The speed of the recovery from the extinction is disputed. Some scientists estimate it took 10 million years until the Middle Triassic, both due to the severity of the extinction and because grim conditions returned periodically for another 5 million years. However, studies in Bear Lake County near Paris, Idaho, showed a relatively quick rebound in a localized early Triassic marine ecosystem, taking about 2 million years to recover. Anyway, it just shows how the Earth has faced its periods of extreme hardship, and life has somehow seemed to peek its head through and survive. And after the extinctions, not only did it come back, but it flourished. So then I'm going to go to the age of the dinosaurs now. So the dinosaurs were here about 65 million years ago. And what that show said, about 66 million years ago, a bunch of volcanoes started to erupt in India. And it could be when India was attached to the Eurasian continent. I'm not exactly sure of the time, but the formation of the Himalayas was India slamming into the Eurasian landmass. So there was these volcanoes that blew high into the sky and clouded the atmosphere, blocked the sun. And so the dinosaurs had already had something, they had faced a hardship before the meteor hit Earth. So when the meteor hit Earth, the dinosaurs were extinct. And some life forms survived. I don't know the exact percentage, but then life came back stronger, and then we have what we have today, which is us. So I believe about 150 million years ago or something, there was the onset of the Homo sapiens. So there's quite a few. I think there's 15 Homo brands. There's like Homo erectus, Homo habilis, Homo sapiens, Homo florentiensis, Homo habilis. There's, as I said, there was about 15. So what happened? There was a great climate change on the Earth, and everything but Homo sapien was killed off. So all the other ones did not adapt to the change of the climate, but Homo sapiens did. And it was at this time, I believe, that the Homo sapiens developed a larger brain, maybe 4 times bigger than it was before, and that got them to, they had the ability to adapt to this serious climate change, where other Homo species did not. So there was, as we can see, the past history of Earth, and just having life survive and evolve under all these hardships, all these conditions, is really quite amazing. So Homo sapiens started to spread out through Asia, and then when the one of those climate change periods, I believe when it was maybe an ice age, I'm not sure, but sea levels went down and ice bridge formed between Alaska and Russia, and then they walked across. So at that time they encountered the great woolly mammoths in North America, and you can see if I stand next to a woolly mammoth, it's going to do away with me. It's going to trample me. I don't have a chance. But somehow with this improved brain capacity, these Homo sapiens figured out a way to subdue the mammoths, kill them off, so they became extinct. And what the geologists were looking at, they noticed how these Homo sapiens, they cut off the heads of these woolly mammoths at precise spots, and then the brain was inside these skulls. They put these brains underwater, and the brains for about a month or maybe two, maybe a month, let's say, they would ferment. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but it made them more suitable for eating. So it showed that the Homo sapiens had this brain power to not only subdue and kill off the woolly mammoths, but then they were smart enough to take the brain of the woolly mammoth and then preserve it underwater so it would be better to eat. So as we can see, these ice ages did not kill off the Homo sapiens. So then they were spreading throughout the world. They spread through North America, and they were at that time hunter-gatherers. They were nomads spreading across, and then finally they discovered agriculture, and then they put down their roots, and there was one of the oldest cities that were talked about on this program that I saw the other night, and I don't see it here. So some are saying a city called Eridu, close to Uruk, was considered the first city in the world. Some say Damascus, some say Jericho, Biblos in Lebanon, Athens, Plovdiv in Bulgaria, Sidon in Lebanon, Fayum in Egypt, Argos, Greece, and Susa in Iran. So the Homo sapiens learned how to plant things. They became farmers, raised animals, and it showed that they were different from all the other species on Earth because, for example, the apes are supposed to be pretty smart, but they didn't build big cities like we have now. So then what happened is, till about 1700 or 1800s, now in our present time, a couple hundred years ago, life was going on as always. There were some inventions, but it took the Industrial Revolution before the mankind really flourished. And taking fossilized carbon under the ground, like oil, coal, gas, and look what we've built now, giant cities, and we're ruining on Earth, though. So there was the ozone problem in the 1990s, which was, I think, solved. So hopefully we can solve our global warming thing. But it's an interesting, I thought, show that talked about how life evolved here on Earth and all the difficulties it had to face and how extinctions came. And then they went, and then life still flourished after them. So if you give life a chance, it will beat the odds, which is really quite amazing. And that's why some scientists believe that life could form elsewhere, because look what life has done on our Earth and the only example that we know of Earth. So that was very interesting, all these mass extinctions and how the human race has overcome them, which is quite an amazing story. So when we look elsewhere in the universe for life beyond our home planet, we think we're most likely to find it lurking somewhere where there's water and where there's a heat source to make this water warm, although we know that seeing living things thrive in more extreme, no, that some living things thrive in some very extreme conditions, the combinations of warmth and water seem to be the most likely requirements for creating an environment that can support some kind of life, at least the kind of life form similar to what we find on Earth. So we have an amazing amount of life forms, and this was a story of the universe as a violent place. And as we saw, there was a lot of violence visited on Earth, a lot of cataclysms, a lot of extinctions, and we survived. So now I'm going to talk more about astronomy, but that is astronomy because it's the story of us. And I've never, as I said maybe a couple months ago, I never thought it would be so interesting to learn about how life evolved here on Earth, and from Brian Cox talking about the proton gradient, which is the spark of life. That's what he said. And also Brian Cox said that he thinks that life is a physical process. It's just follows the laws of physics. So if it follows the laws of physics, then there's got to be life elsewhere. That's what he says. So when I come back, I'm going to talk about a different topic, but I'll give you some stuff to think about. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam Nisiyaya, Thinkum Queen Ansem, Hydra CM, Nisiyam Nisiyaya,
Anthas Yahuya, Talitin, Homasque Mustayo.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
So welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. So you know how much I love telescopes, and especially those big monster telescopes. I couldn't believe it that somebody like Hubble, his job was to look through a telescope a lot. What an amazing career. What an amazing existence. So I'm talking about another kind of telescope now that is facing some trouble. It's called the Arecibo Telescope, and this is an article from LiveScience.com, and it's dated 17 hours ago. So I'm talking now, it's early morning Wednesday, about 1:15 a.m. So 17 hours ago would be Tuesday, which is December 1st. So this article comes from you, LiveScience.com, on December 1st. It's by Mindy Weisberger. And again, the title is Broken Arecibo Telescope Collapses, Ending in an Era of Alien Hunting. So snap cables left the iconic instrument damaged beyond repair. So there's a picture here of the Arecibo Observatory's radio telescope was built in a natural sinkhole in Puerto Rico. Construction was completed in 1963. Okay, I'm going to start reading the article. A broken cable was the final straw for the already badly damaged Arecibo Observatory's radio telescope in Puerto Rico. The massive structure's 900-ton instrument platform collapsed on Tuesday, December 1st, and landed on the 1,000-foot-wide or 305-meter radio dish. The cable parted at around 8 a.m. local time. Ramon Lugo, director of the Florida Space Institute, FIS, at the University of Central Florida, told Science Magazine. The FIS manages the telescope, which is owned by the National Science Foundation. imagine you have something break that you own and you say, my phone broke, or my voice recorder phone broke, or my glasses broke. But then you have to tell your cohorts, our telescope broke. That would be a real downer. While details of the collapse are still forthcoming, the previous failures of two cables in August and November, respectively, placed an extra burden on the remaining support structures. During the past week, the cables that were still in place were rapidly unraveling, losing about one wire per day. No one was injured in the incident, which was confirmed in the tweet by the National Science Foundation. The National Science Foundation said in its tweet, and quote, NFS is working with stakeholders to assess the situation. Our top priority is maintaining safety, end quote. Deborah Martirel, a meteorologist in Puerto Rico, posted side-by-side photos on Twitter this morning at 7:18 a.m. local time, showing two very different views of Arecibo. In one image, taken Monday, November 30, the instrument platform is visible over the treetops, but in the second photo, captured Tuesday morning, the platform is gone. So here it shows the damage. So that's terrible, isn't it? Your telescope is kaput. It's gone. It shows here the photos and side-by-side photos. Built in a natural sinkhole in 1963, Arecibo was the world's biggest single-dish telescope at the time of its construction. Astronomers used its massive dish to detect near-Earth objects such as asteroids, and in 1974 it broadcast the now famous Arecibo message, declaring the technical prowess of humanity to any intelligent extraterrestrials that might be listening. But after standing for 57 years, Arecibo had its worst year ever in 2020. Earthquakes in January shook the iconic telescope, and then one of its heavy cables snapped on August 10th, ripping a gaping 100-foot, 30-meter gash in the delicate dish. Just a few months later, on November 6th, another cable failed, this one a main support cable for the tower that had already lost the cable in August. Though scientists hoped the telescope could be repaired, the damage was too great, and the NSF announced on November 19th that they would decommission Arecibo. NFS is saddened by the development, the agency wrote. As we move forward, we will be looking for ways to assist the scientific community and maintain our strong relationship with the people of Puerto Rico. So, of course, that's quite a sad thing that a beautiful instrument like that doing science has collapsed. Now let's move on to China. So China is active in the space race, and this article is from LiveScience.com. The title is China's Chang'e 5 lands on the moon to collect the first fresh lunar sample in decades. This is dated 17 hours ago, so that means December 1st, by Mike Wall. So there's a photo, an artist's illustration of China's Chang'e moon sample return spacecraft on the lunar surface. China has apparently landed on the moon again, and this time the country plans to bring home some souvenirs. Chang'e 5, China's first ever sample return mission, successfully touched down today, December 1st, according to state media reports. Details on the landing were not immediately available from the China National Space Administration, but the state-run CGTN news station announced the landing success in a single sentence statement. Chang'e 5E's landing was expected to occur at about 10:13 a.m. Eastern Time near Mons Rumker, a mountain in the Oceanus Procellarum, Ocean of Storm region of the moon. Two pieces of the four-module 18,100-pound or 8,200-kilogram Chang'e 5 mission hit the gray dirt today, a stationary lander and an ascent vehicle. If all goes according to plan, the lander will spend the next few days collecting about 4.4 pounds or 2 kilograms of lunar material, some of it dug up from 6.5 feet or 2 meters beneath the lunar surface. So I don't know how deep the Apollo Apollo mission went. So on this right here, there's a video of the separation of Chang'e 5's moon lander from its module. Again, this article is called China's Chang'e 5 lands on the moon to collect the first fresh lunar sample in decades. So I'm going to press this and see how this separation goes. So the separation is 1 minute and 23. Oh, that's really cool. You got to see this. China's Chang'e 5 lander separates from the orbiter. So it looks beautiful. Wow, is that amazing? It's beautiful. Looks like a space age. Two of the four modules that make up Chang'e moon sample return mission began their journey to the moon. So that's very beautiful picture. The sample will then be transferred to the ascent vehicle, which will launch to lunar orbit and meet up with the other two Chang'e 5 elements, an orbiter and an Earth return craft. The return vehicle will haul the moon dirt and rocks to our planet with a touchdown planned in Inner Mongolia in mid-December. That will be a landmark event. Pristine lunar samples have not been delivered into the Earth since 1976, when the Soviet Union's Luna 24 mission came home with about 6 ounces or 170 grams of material. So this just made me think, what's going to happen in 5, 10, 20, 30 years from now? Who owns the moon? Who has ownership? Who decides who gets the benefit? Which country gets the benefits? Which country can take over a certain part of the moon? I believe during George Bush's presidency, someone was selling parts of the moon, but then it was declared illegal. So you could have owned property on the moon. Cool. Chang'e 5 just launched November 23, so it's packing a lot of action into a few short weeks. The compressed timeline is driven largely by the mission's energy needs. The Chang'e 5 lander is solar powered, so it must get all of its work done in 2 Earth weeks at most before the sun set at Mons Rumiker. One lunar day lasts about 29 Earth days. So most moon sites receive 2 weeks of continuous sunlight, followed by 2 weeks of darkness. Chang'e 5 is the latest mission in the Chang'e program of robotic lunar exploration, which is named after a moon goddess in Chinese mythology. The Chang'e 1 and Chang'e 2 orbiters launched in 2007 and 2010, respectively, and Chang'e 3 put a lander rover duo down on the moon near side in December 2013. The Chang'e 5 T1 mission sent a prototype return capsule around the moon and back to Earth in October 2014 to help prepare for Chang'e 5. And in January 2019, the Chang'e 4 lander rover duo pulled off the first ever soft touchdown on the moon's mysterious, largely unexplored far side. Both Chang'e 4 robots remain operational today as the Chang'e 3 lander. Ooh. Though Chang'e 5's operational life will be short, the mission is designed to have a long-lasting impact. After all, scientists are still studying the 842 pounds or 382 kilograms of lunar material brought to Earth by NASA's Apollo missions from 1969 to 1972. So a person like me who's an astronomer who loves astronomy, I think there was so much time lost when the Apollo missions were canceled and moon exploration didn't keep going. Imagine if we had settlements on the moon now, wouldn't that be cool? Some of the Apollo material came from Oceanus Procellarum, a huge volcanic plain that Apollo 12 explored in late 1969. But Mons Rumiker rocks formed just 1.2 billion years ago, where all of the samples collected by the Apollo astronauts are more than 3 billion years old. Chang'e 5 therefore will help scientists understand what was happening late in the moon's history, as well as how Earth and the solar system evolved. Chang'e 5 isn't the only sample return game in town. Japan's Hayabusa 2 mission is scheduled to deliver pieces of the asteroid Ryugu to Earth on December 5th, and NASA's OSIRIS-REx probe collected samples of the space rock Bennu in late October. The Bennu samples are scheduled to come home in September 2023. So, space exploration goes on. Okay, so That's China's space program. Okay, so where is it? More about China. I'm getting the same. No, that's Arecibo. So I'm going to go for a break now. When I come back, I'm going to talk more astronomy on AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. Now, here's one of these stories that grabs your attention. It was 2 hours ago, so I believe it's dated December 2nd, because these are probably Eastern time, and it's by Michelle Starr. The title is, Our Solar System Will Disintegrate Sooner Than We Thought. So this is on LifeScience.com. I'm going to read that title again. Our solar system will disintegrate sooner than we thought. That's good to know. But don't worry, it's still billions and billions of years away. So as we know, one day the Andromeda galaxy will merge with ours, but that's still a long time away as well, 3 million years from now. So here's a white dwarf star after ejecting its mass to form a planetary nebula. Okay, although the ground beneath our feet feels solid and reassuring most of the time, nothing in this universe lasts forever. One day, our sun will die, ejecting a large proportion of its mass before its core shrinks down into a white dwarf, gradually leaking heat until it's nothing more than a cold, dark, dead lump of rock 1,000 trillion years later. So I think that's called a black dwarf. But the rest of the solar system will be long gone by then. According to new simulations, it will take just 100 billion years for any remaining planets to skedaddle off across the galaxy, leaving the dying sun far behind. Astronomers and physicists have been trying to puzzle out the ultimate fate of the solar system for at least hundreds of years. So here's a video, 10 years of the sun in six minutes. And if you want to look at it, again, this article is called Our Solar System Will Disintegrate Sooner Than We Thought on LifeScience.com. So says astronomer John Zink of the University of California, Los Angeles, and Constantine Batygin of Caltech and Fred Adams of the University of Michigan in a new paper, and quote, understanding the long-term dynamical stability of the solar system constitutes one of the oldest pursuits of astrophysics, tracing back to Newton himself, who speculated that mutual interaction between planets would eventually drive the system unstable. End quote. But that's a lot trickier than it might seem. Let's read that again. Understanding the long-term dynamical stability of the solar system constitutes one of the older pursuits of astrophysics, tracing back to Newton, who speculated that mutual interactions between planets would eventually drive the system unstable. Okay, so Newton thought that interactions of planets would make the system unstable. But that's a lot trickier than it might seem. The greater the number of bodies that are involved in a dynamical system interacting with each other, the more complicated that system grows, and the harder it is to predict. This is called the n-body problem, or I thought it was called the many-body problem. Because of this complexity, it's impossible to make deterministic predictions of the orbits of solar system objects past certain timescales. Beyond about 5 to 10 million years, certainty flies right out the window. But if we can figure out what's going to happen to our solar system, that will tell us something about how the universe might evolve on timescales far longer than its current age of 13.8 billion years. In 1999, astronomers predicted that the solar system would slowly fall apart over a period of at least a billion years. That's 10 to the 18, or a quintillion years. That's how long it would take. They calculated for orbital resonance from Jupiter and Saturn to decompose Uranus. According to Zink's team, though, this calculation left out some important influences that could disrupt the solar system sooner. Firstly, there's the sun. In about 5 billion years, as it dies, the sun will swell up into a red giant, engulfing Mercury, Venus, and Earth. I've heard different things about Earth. I heard that because the sun is passing, are getting bigger, it's going to push the Earth out as it expands. So who knows what's going to happen. But it could. It seems like it will definitely eat up Mercury and Venus and then possibly Earth. Then it will eject nearly half its mass, blow away into space on stellar winds. The remaining white dwarf will be around just 54% of the current solar mass. This mass loss will loosen the sun's gravitational grip on the remaining planets, Mars and the outer gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Secondly, as the solar system orbits the galactic center, other stars ought to come close enough to perturb the planet's orbits around once every 23 million years. So again, what I heard or what I thought happened in, for example, as the solar system, or let's say the Milky Way galaxy orbits, or sorry, as the solar system orbits the center of our galaxy, I think that's called a galactic year, 230 to 240 million years, it bobbles, like it weaves up and down like a sine wave. So sometimes it goes above and sometimes below the gravitational protection provided by the Milky Way itself. So these things are definitely very complicated. These previous researchers wrote, by accounting for stellar mass loss and the inflation of the outer planet orbits, these encounters will become more influential. Given enough time, some of these flybys will come close enough to dissociate or destabilize the remaining planets, end quote. With these additional influences accounted in their calculations, the team ran a 10 n-body simulation for the outer planets, leaving out Mars to save on computation costs, since its influence should be negligible, using the powerful Sherrod-Hoffman 2 cluster. These simulations were split into two phases, one up, this is interesting stuff, up to the end of the sun's mass loss, and the phase that comes after. Although 10 simulations isn't a strong statistical sample, the team found that a similar scenario played out each time. After the sun completes its evolution into a white dwarf, the outer planets have a larger orbit, but still remain relatively stable. Jupiter and Saturn, however, become captured in a stable 5-2 resonance. For every 5 times Jupiter orbits the sun, Saturn orbits twice. That eventual resonance has been proposed many times, not least by Isaac Newton himself. These expanded orbits, as well as characteristics of the planetary resonance, makes the system more susceptible to perturbations by passing stars. After 30 billion years, such stellar perturbations jangle these stable orbits into chaotic ones, resulting in rapid planet loss. All but one planet escapes their orbit, fleeing off into the galaxy as rogue planets. That last lonely planet sticks around for another 50 billion years, but its fate is sealed. Eventually, it too is knocked loose by the gravitational influence of passing stars. Ultimately, by 100 billion years after the sun turns into a white dwarf, the solar system is no more. Wow, so cool. That's a significantly shorter time frame than that proposed in 1999. And the researchers carefully note it's contingent on current observations of the local galactic environment and stellar flyby estimates, both of which may change. So it's by no means engraved in stone. Even in estimates of the timeline of our solar system demise do change. However, it's still many billions of years away. The likelihood of humanity surviving long enough to see it is slim. Sleep tight. So that's pretty cool research. This research has been published in the Astronomical Journal. So again, this article was called Our Solar System Will Disintegrate Sooner Than We Thought. So I'm going to take a break now. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
سلام، روزتون بخیر. My name is Sahad, the president of UBC Persian Club.
And this is Yasaman, the VP admin.
UBC Persian Club is a non-profit student organization with the goal of empowering the Iranian community at UBC by acting as a social hub for Iranian students, bringing together diverse members of the community who have a common interest in Iranian culture, and nurturing and representing the Iranian community in Vancouver.
We have monthly member-exclusive events, Pelon, we screen documentary movies and short films by Iranian directors with English subtitles. Music gatherings, a series of casual music gatherings at which students can play different types of instruments, and sports events and game nights.
Our regular events are member exclusive and you will receive 25% discount on our annual events. You can visit us at ubcpc.com or email us through info@ubcpc.com.
Or you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
Come enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost. Check us out online at ubc-voc.com.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk. Now there's a couple of things I'm going to look at about black holes. One article is called Dangerous Naked Black Holes Could Be Hiding in the Universe. Not dangerous, trust. We're not going anywhere. And swarms of primordial black holes might fill our universe. Let's look at that one. It's on livescience.com 6 days ago, which is something like November 26th or 27th. Beware the primordial black hole. So again, this article is called Swarms of Primordial Black Holes Might Fill Our Universe. The universe might be full of tiny ancient black holes, and researchers might be able to prove it. These mini black holes from the beginning of time, or primordial black holes, PBHs, were first dreamed up decades ago. Researchers proposed them as an explanation for dark matter, an unseen substance that exerts a gravitational pull throughout space. Most explanations for dark matter involve hypothetical particles with special properties that help them evade detection. But some researchers think swarms of little black holes moving like clouds through space offer a cleaner explanation. Now, a new study explains where these primordial black holes might have come from and how astronomers could detect the aftershocks of their birth. So where did these little black holes come from? A black hole is a singularity, an infinitely dense point in space packed with matter. It forms when that matter gets so tightly packed that the force of gravity overwhelms everything else and the matter collapses. It warps space-time and surrounds itself on an event horizon, a spherical boundary region beyond which no light can escape. So of course we know that stars, something like 10 times the mass of the sun, 9 or 10, they will eventually end life as in a supernova explosion. And what's left of that supernova explosion is massive enough to squish all of it into a singularity, a point, and it becomes a black hole with an event horizon. The laws of general relativity allow black holes to exist at any scale. Crush an ant hard enough and it will collapse into a black hole just like a star. It'll just be incredibly tiny. So what I heard before, what I know from before is, I think if you take all the mass of the Earth and squish it into the size of a cube, it will become a black hole, like a cube of sugar. So we could become a black hole too. Most, what's PBH stand for again? Primordial black hole. So PBH stands for primordial black hole. Most primordial black hole theories assume these objects have masses like small planets, with event horizons as small as grapefruits. It's an outlandish idea, still on the fringe of black hole and dark matter physics, and said Joey Nielsen, a physicist at Villanova University. Joey Nielsen, a physicist at Villanova University, who was not involved in a new study. But recently, as other dark matter theories have turned up empty, some researchers have given the primordial black hole notion a second look. If primordial black holes are out there, though, They have to be very old. In the modern universe, there are only two known methods for creating new black holes from normal matter. Stars much heavier than the Sun, colliding or exploding. So every known black hole weighs more than the entire solar system, sometimes much, much more. So I think that supermassive black hole, the center of our solar system, center of our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, weighs about 4.3 million solar masses. And I believe I recall the one at the Andromeda galaxy could weigh something like 6 to 9 billion solar masses. So they're pretty big babies. Making small black holes requires a whole other set of mechanisms and ingredients. Those ingredients with a Big Bang, the same stuff that makes the stars and the galaxies, Nielsen told Life Science. Right after the Big Bang, the newly expanding universe was full of hot, dense, largely undifferentiated matter expanding in all directions. There were small pockets of turbulence in this morass, still visible as fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, CMB, the afterglow of the Big Bang, and those fluctuations give the universe structure. So said Nielsen, and quote, if it's a little more dense at point A, then stuff is gravitationally attracted to point A. And over the history of the universe, that attraction causes gas and dust to fall inwards, coalesce, collapse, and form the stars, galaxy, and all the structures in the universe. End quote. Most primordial black hole theories involve very intense fluctuations in the early universe, stronger than the ones that form galaxies. In this new paper, the researchers place those intense fluctuations during a period known as inflation. In the first 1,000 billionths of a second after the Big Bang, the universe expanded exponentially fast. That rapid early expansion gave space-time its current flat shape, researchers believe, and it likely prevented space from ended up curved, Life Science has previously reported. Okay, that's nice to know. In a new paper, November 20, but I've heard this stuff before, and who can know exactly what happened the first thousandth, billionth of a second. So these guys are pretty smart if they can figure that out. In a new paper published November 20 to the ARXIV database, researchers proposed that during inflation, there might have been moments where all of space-time was intensely curved before eventually flattening out. Those brief curvatures, however, would have produced fluctuations in the expanding universe, intense enough to eventually form a large population of Earth mass black holes. Isn't that cool? That's why I lost my place. I somehow toggled something. I'm sorry. Let me... Earth... Sorry about this. Okay, I'm just going to... Making small black holes requires a whole other set of mechanisms. Those ingredients will be the stuff of the Big Bang, the same stuff that made the stars and galaxies. Right after the Big Bang, the newly expanding universe was full of hot, dense, largely undifferentiated matter expanding in all directions. There were small pockets of turbulence, still visible as fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, the afterglow of the Big Bang, and those fluctuations gave the universe structure. Most primordial black hole theories involve very intense fluctuations in the universe, stronger than the one that formed up galaxies. Okay, here I found my place. I'm going to read that last sentence again. Those brief curvatures, however, would have produced fluctuations in the expanding universe, intense enough to eventually form a large population of Earth mass black holes. So what I did, I accidentally toggled my mouse, and it went up half a page, so I'm sorry about that. So now there's a subsection called How to Find Tiny Black Holes. The easiest way to prove this theory correct is to look for secondary gravitational waves, or SGWs. I'm always learning new acronyms. Secondary gravitational waves, SGWs, echoing around the universe, the researchers wrote. These waves, much weaker than gravitational waves produced by colliding black holes, would ring out from the same perturbations that formed the primordial black holes. They'd be subtle vibrations in the universe, inaudible to current detectors, but two future methods might be able to find them. One approach, pulsar timing arrays. Spaces full of whirling neutron stars, known as pulsars, that send flashes of energy towards Earth as they spin. Pulsars are like precise, predictable ticking clocks in the sky, but their signals can get distorted by gravitational waves. A secondary gravitational wave passing between Earth and a pulsar would warp space-time, causing the pulsar's tick to arrive a bit early or late in ways a pulsar array could detect. Pretty cool. There's a problem with this plan, though. Pulsar timing arrays would rely on precisely detecting the ticks of pulsars that emit radio waves. And one of the world's most important radio detectors, the giant Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico, which I talked about earlier, has essentially been destroyed. But even if a high-quality pulsar timing experiment doesn't work out in the next 15 years, the next generation of gravitational wave detectors should be sensitive enough to pick up these secondary gravitational rays. Radiational wave detectors are buried underground, looking for fluctuations in space-time by measuring changes in the travel time of light across land. By the early effects, minor earthquakes, waves pounded against distant shores, and even rabbits hopping around overhead can muddy the signal. In 2034, the European Space Agency plans to launch the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, LISA, a far more sensitive space-based gravitational wave detector that avoids those pitfalls. And LISA, the authors wrote, should be able to pick up secondary gravitational waves. Such a detection, they were the primordial black holes, account for most, if not all, of the dark matter in the universe. Now, wouldn't that be cool? Okay, so thank you for listening. Again, I thought this was an interesting show because I like astronomy and it's interesting. So thank you for listening. This was Marco for AstroTalk for December 3rd, 2020. See you next.